Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm Mira. We are associated members of ML4Q.
And you're listening to ML4 Q&A, a show where members from the Matter and Light for Quantum Computing cluster talk about their careers, their research, and the future of quantum.
In this episode, we are excited to welcome ML4Q member Alex Altlam. We talk with him about his role as one of the designated spokespersons for ML4Q's next funding phase, which is not yet granted at the time of recording. With decision day looming this May 2025, he'll share behind-the-scenes insights on coordinating the massive application.
He also reflects on more than 6 years in the ML4Q community, highlighting key collaborations and projects. His research focus is on quantum field theory, quantum chaos, and topological matter. But of course, we also discuss his passion for teaching and writing popular textbooks, as well as his early career.
Interestingly, he also transitioned from an early interest in chemistry to becoming a deeply conceptual theoretical physicist. There seems to be a recurring pattern of future professors briefly venturing into finance or consulting, only to return to academia with renewed enthusiasm. Mario Betta's story in the previous episode is another example.
But now let's dive into what physics looks like from a conceptual and mathematical perspective with Alex Altlam.
Alex, we are very happy to have you on the ML4Q and A podcast. Welcome. It's really great to have you here because you are you became this spokesperson and sort of coordinator for the ML4Q renewal. We will start with your career and then get to that. Let's start with how did you become a physicist? What was your path into physics?
Okay. Yeah, thanks for having me. first, I have to point out we are actually three spokespersons.
Oh, yeah.
ML4Q. My colleagues Silvia Papaladi and Christoph Stampfer from Aachen. Silvia is here in Cologne. And myself, so I'm one of three. How did I become a physicist? I didn't intend to. When I was in school, I was actually a super crack in chemistry. I was absolutely into chemistry. I don't understand anymore why, but it just that's what how it was. So I understood everything about chemistry. I started studying chemistry. The one thing about chemistry I did not understand is that it's an experimental science. And I'm not an experimenter. So I had to learn the hard way, and after one term dropped out and switched to physics, which was fortunately not quite as experimental. And that's how it started, yes. And from that point on, I was passionate about physics, yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any important influences in your career, like some specific mentors or books or any events that shaped your path?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, several, actually. I'm quite old. I started studying physics in Marburg, and there I learned about this super famous guy Wegener in Heidelberg. And then I actually went to study with him and to Heidelberg, and he was one of my idols and still is. I mean, one of the best physicists we have had in Germany and in the 20th century. Then a little later came the episode, yeah, when the Iron Curtain came down, late 80s, early 90s. And this wave of Russian physicists came through, just freshly emigrated from Moscow or Leningrad on their way to the US, stopping over at our Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg, and they were kind of bored, and in their boredom started to talk to me and educate me in their Russian style, and this was a massive influence. So I got exposed to this Soviet style of doing proper physics with small parameters and diagrams and all that stuff you could not learn quite such a form here, and that was an absolutely strong influence which for throughout my entire career, and it put me on this quantum field theory path for the rest of my scientific career. Yes.
So it basically, I mean, this Russian school is very mathematical. Did you, like, at what point in your career did you find the Landau books? Did you ever look into them?
Yeah, actually, I never liked them, strangely, which was, I didn't become quite Russian. I mean, the Landau books, they all told me that they are also genius-like books. And it was a little bit the way beyond me, the way Landau explained stuff. So there's another one which you may not know, Abrikosov, Gorkov, Dzerzhinsky. That one I liked a lot, but No, I never did Land of Theories, and never my books.
Yeah, also I have to admit I didn't find it very accessible when I read it. It's not there's a lot sort of left unsaid, and I don't know, it's like from today's pedagogical perspective you would think that it's useful to show somebody how to get from one formula to the next formula.
It also teaches too much, and frankly also not quite the direction I'm super foremostly interested in. So
But yeah, so you're early on, you were already like, you sort of became a very mathematical physicist, let's say, a physicist with a strong background in the math for quantum field theory and so on.
Somebody told me that this is saying that somebody is always somebody else's mathematical physicist.
Yes.
So many people consider me as super applied and basic guy, and others consider me as hardcore mathematical. It just depends on the perspective. But I think, I mean, within this area of condensed matter, I'm leaning more towards the more formal.
Yeah. Formal. I mean, previous guests, we just had Frank Wilhelm Mauch. He's, for example, much more applied. Like he will actually go to the experimentalist and say, well, can I actually model what exactly is happening in your experiment? And you're more sort of broad strokes and telling the experimentalist, maybe you should consider this.
Not even that.
Or not even that.
I have to admit. I mean, I'm definitely not very much leaning to the experimental side of physics. To put it diplomatically, I mean, yeah. So I'm more interested in concepts actually, and I'm not so much in phenomena.
Mm-hmm. So, a conceptual physicist, maybe that's the right word.
Yeah, I think nails it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not that people interested in experiment aren't conceptual, but I'm more interested in understanding large structures instead of specific experiments.
And how do you become that kind of physicist? Let's say it's very easy to say how do you become an experimental physicist? You know, you go into somebody's lab and you start to learn the trade, and it's really like almost like learning a skill, right? But this type of physics that you are doing, is it similar? Do you just find another conceptual physicist that mentors you, and then you grow into it?
I think there's two. It's a difficult question, but there's two factors involved. One is emotions. You have to be emotionally attracted to what you're doing. And the second is, I think we all have specific types of intelligence. I mean, for example, I always flatline when I see an experimental apparatus in this physics practical things. I could not translate between formulas and a signal on the screen. Other people were much better with that. And it's just that my thinking is more inclined to this structures one encounters in field theory or mathematical theories.
Did you always wanted to become a professor, or was it a gradual journey into academia?
Nope, I did not. Actually, there is this kind of famous episode when I, after my second degree, Habilitation, I actually left physics for a little while. For 1 week, I became a consultant.
Oh.
And then I came back. I was always, it was a bit difficult for me. I was passionate about physics, but not so much the career tracks that go with it. And eventually I managed to become a professor, but it was not a plan. When I became professor, I was almost ready to say, okay, we give it another 1 or 2 years and then I do something else. Yeah.
What would have been the alternative? You said consultancy already, you ruled out after a bit.
That's another good question. It would have been difficult for me to answer this question, but I was prepared to face it in earnest. Mm-hmm. And I was, because there's so many interesting things you can do in life. I mean,
what are the cool things about being a professor that kept you doing it?
Lots of, actually. I mean, when I became consultant, I had to cycle out to some office here in Hürth and open my Excel spreadsheet or some database related to some Ford stuff. And at the same time, there was a workshop in Santa Barbara ongoing on some subject I forgot, but I knew I can be in Santa Barbara and think about cool things. And I mean, what is it? I mean, you have a lot of freedom. You don't have a boss. It's an enormous amount of work. I mean, all myself and all my colleagues, we work like hell, but working a lot is easier when you basically don't have rigid confines.
When did you run into quantum information theory, which now, you know, is a big thing in ML4Q and which you now also contribute to? But I guess in your, what was the moment when you noticed this?
So, metaphorically speaking, quantum information theory grew next to me in parallel. I mean, so it, and I just didn't notice. It was, I was interested in other things. And so at about 2010 or so, it became unavoidable. I mean, I had to know a bit of what's going on. And I'm actually not contributing in any way to quantum information theory. The field is at a level where I simply cannot do. I'm trying to dock to these developments trying to make what I know useful to certain aspects of it. I mean, good example is, maybe we'll get into that, is work on many body aspects of quantum computers and so on. But quantum information theory is also something that requires its own intuition, and I just don't have this intuition. Okay. I cannot think in terms of entanglement entropies or all this. I mean, people are so fast with this concept these days. It's just not me. I mean,
so I have to, I mean, I, when I was studying, I saw both things. So I had some lectures about, you know, quantum field theory, and I also had the lectures on quantum information theory. Mm-hmm. And for me, the quantum information theory was very appealing because, you know, in field theory, you basically already have to understand the residual theorem and all this math stuff around it, which people keep going to. Well, in quantum information theory, it's mainly, you know, somewhat matrices. And like, as long as it's finite dimensional, it's sort of like any idiot like me can go to a laptop and check it out numerically quickly.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, if you want to be cruel, you would say it's all linear algebra, yeah? Quantum information. And field theory and many body theory and all this, yeah, they certainly have their learning curve. But that's not to say that quantum information theory is easier. I mean, it's just that the methodological framework is a little bit more restricted, but then the art form is to actually identify questions and describe phenomena in this language and conceptualize things. And this is where it's getting arbitrarily complex. Yeah. And I just cannot do this. I can look at people in awe and see, oh, wow, I can do this. I can't. So I wouldn't say it's easy. I know, not at all.
Quantum information theory is fairly new compared to condensed matter physics. How do you view the evolution of condensed matter physics since the late 80s?
Oh, that's also an interesting one. Actually, I don't consider myself as a condensed matter physicist. Mm-hmm. I'm not even... Condensed metaphysics, for my particular taste, has so many phenomena. I find it dazzling. I mean, it makes me confused. There's so infinitely many different systems. And on the other hand, what's good about it is you actually have phenomena which you can explain. I mean, this is not self-understood. Now in quantum information, and all this, it's much harder. Yeah, in condensed matter, you have an experiment. There is a curve, and you explain this curve, and ideally you do that analytically. This type of cycle is less developed in info. But there is a third field which belongs to this, and that's particle physics. So I've always been interested in physics at the interface between quantum and particle physics. In particle, you have a little less of phenomenological freedom, but you have these extremely beautiful set of concepts, and many of them find applications in quantum. In relativistic quantum matter and anomalies and topological matter, and this I find super fascinating and attractive. And these days, for example, I like to think about holographic principles, which are intrinsically a concept in string theory. I work with string theorists, and it's all quite closely connected to stuff, statistical physics and quantum chaos we are doing. So this is where I really see my home turf. That was not the question. The question was about the development of condensed matter. Right. I would say, in principle, super healthy. I mean, so condensed matter, I think, is always driven by something new coming up, which then really is like a sun, I mean, shining on one decade. Like in the 80s, we had the quantum Hall effects. In the 90s, we had well, this mesoscopic physics coming up, quantum devices. In the 0 years, we had topological quantum matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm not quite sure what we have, but I'm certain something will come again. I mean, these phenomena come every few years, and so the field regenerates itself.
For example, one of the things, like interactions are always an important part, and you try to go from, maybe you can map interacting fermions to, you know, non-interacting fermions and mm-hmm. solve it. But I guess we're now getting computationally more and more into the regime where we can maybe tackle some of the correlated physics from a computational angle better and better. Do you think that we will actually crack them, or will this remain? Is this just so hard?
I don't think so. I mean, classical computers will be limited to, or stay limited to, a handful of degrees of freedom. And that's just not nearly enough to make really conclusive statements about universal physics that unfolds and systems which are approaching thermodynamic limits, which is the type of questions condensed matter asks. For that, we need quantum computers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm optimistic that we will see quantum computers relatively soon that can make an impact in many body physics.
Yeah.
Going to, 100, 200 spins. That would be a game changer.
For example, we have these superconductor, like the high TC superconductor Hamiltonians, right? Mm. Which are like, yeah. I mean, it's just not even nice to write them down, right? They're horrendous.
Yeah.
Like, do you think that quantum computers will actually make a dent into this, or is it just?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Give you an example. I mean, one of the paradigmatic systems in the strong correlation physics, the 2000s, has been the Z2 gauge theory. Gauge theory with binary degrees of freedom. And my colleague Achim Roche always told me, in condensed matter, we don't have a single example of a Z2 gauge theory. There's so much research, but it's so difficult to me. Now at Google, they are building these things. So that's not yet a superconductor, but Z2 gauge theory, including its topological phases, it's already quite something. And they do this on, I don't know, they are now, how's their new chip called?
Yeah,
I
think,
Willow, 105 qubits. So it's, and super reliable cubes. So I think we will see something. And these will be the first applications of quantum computers. And I think we can forget about fertilizer and prime factorization. The first applications will be super powerful applications in the physical sciences. And we will see them soon, I think.
But indeed, the early systems are very abstract systems that maybe don't exist in other materials. Would you be confident that we can map from sort of this, Pauli situation into a real systems?
Yeah, I mean, one thing we can write a textbook statement. Yeah, many real physical theories, for good reasons, which we can discuss, contain a Z2 gauge theory at their core.
Okay.
So it's hardwired into them. So you better understand the theory very well. And I think quantum computers make contributions to understanding these classes of systems. And they will make them relatively soon. So I don't think this is so abstract than it sounds.
So at this point, it looks like theory is more advanced than the things that we work with practically.
Yeah, that's also, I mean, it's an interesting, like it's sort of inverting the order of things usually, right? Like as you said, in old condensed matter physics, some experimentalist came to some old Russian theorist and said, we see some, dip in resistivity or peak in resistivity as we cool down.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I think we are, right now we are walking on relatively thin ice. I mean, there is a huge overhead in theory building, and to what extent, I mean, classical numerics is no longer the tool of choice, and at what point actual quantum devices will catch up, and will they catch up before the field runs into a crisis? I don't know. I mean, we have to see. Moderately optimistic that it will all work out, but these theories we have, theory building, really looks dazzling, I mean, in its complexity, to me, as a layperson.
Yes.
So we can talk about being a spokesperson for ML4Q. What is an excellence cluster like ML4Q? What does it do?
What does it do, yeah? That's actually a good question. I mean, when excellence clusters came up, I was asking myself the very same question, and I was actually quite critical. I thought that they are too large. Excellence clusters cover... In Heidelberg, they have this excellence clusters, which is just called structures. Structures, I mean, mathematics, structures in nature science. It's getting too large. I mean, I knew from previous work in Sonderforschungsbereichen or CRC that they represent quite powerful groups of people who actually act like a family and they are coherent. And I thought clusters are too large. But I've changed my mind witnessing what clusters can do. And it's quite impressive. I mean, this, and we can take our cluster as an example. I think we really grew here together as a research region and also as people and facilities and topics, and that worked. We are topically quite far-stretched. I mean, for me, it's a universe, and I don't understand one bit of what many of my colleagues said, but it's simply connected. So it's a bit like an organic structure and quite a powerful one. So I think that's the mission primarily of clusters. I mean,
yeah,
building...
It comes from this Excellence Initiative, which mm-hmm. is a German federal... like the German federal government trying to interfere with the universities, which is technically a state's thing in Germany. Yes. So very similar to the US as well. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest funding tool that there is.
Yeah, when they started this whole Excellence, they had three funding lines, research schools, clusters, and the universities themselves. The schools were abandoned at some point. But the clusters, I think they are... And I heard that they are now... This instrument is about to be copied on the European scale by others, so it's considered, I think...
A success.
And especially the longevity of it. I mean, this project is something which is exceptional on the international scale.
Yeah.
It's a good concept, I think. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that some of your colleagues do work on very, very different topics that probably you don't understand.
Yeah.
But did you, under this excellence cluster, did you venture out of your comfort zone and into some topics that mm-hmm. are very, very different?
Yeah, I did, and several others did as well. I mean, it's something it's quite a mundane process. You just start chatting to one of your colleagues at a conference and you realize, oh, there is something you can do. I mean, in my case, this was this anecdote where we thought that all these concepts of quantum chaos I like so much might be relevant to the transmon qubit.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is a transmon? It's a pendulum, mathematical pendulum. So two transmon is two pendula. And this is a textbook example of classical chaos. We thought, maybe there is something. And then started to colleagues who actually knew transmons, like David DiVincenzo and other people, and we learned, oh, this is so much more fun. I mean, doing this chaos stuff in a rather with a transmon than with an abstract billiard. And this is how it started. And I think similar dynamics happened with many other people.
Maybe we can discuss a bit this special case just mm-hmm. to have a brief interlude of making it more concrete what these clusters do. Indeed, like the original transmon paper, for example, does have this mechanical analogy in it, right? So I guess when you open this paper, I guess it's a nice paper. It's technically a theory paper, right? And it's a pretty simple Hamiltonian. How hard was it for you to get into the ideas of the transmon?
No, that wasn't hard. I mean, the transmon is, you can do this in any quantum mechanics one. You take a mathematical pendulum, I mean really pendulum, and quantize it.
And you add some nonlinearity.
Transmon. But the trouble starts when you couple several of these guys, and you know lots of coupled pendula is this deeply dangerous system, and it's the total antagonist of what we associate with a quantum computer. A quantum computer should be reliable and contrary. I mean, so that I couldn't square this. Yeah. And then I realized that you invite two devils at the same time. On the one hand, you have this chaos, and then you tame this chaos by introducing disorder. So you invite another dangerous guy. And the intuition is, it's another lecture course thing. If you want to avoid a resonance, you can make your system random so you don't get dangerous resonances like when army units march over a bridge, they do this. Yeah, yeah. And this is exactly what they're doing in a transport processor. And I thought, wow, this is courageous. And we looked deeper into that.
I actually have a paper on, like, one of my earliest papers was on whether you could reuse microwave sources in the control of transmons, with the idea that indeed on your chip you would, you know, make every second or every fifth transmon the same frequency, mm-hmm. In order to save hardware, right? Because you, like, every frequency that you have, you need to at some point have a piece of hardware that makes that microwave radiation. So. Yes. And indeed, it's a very interesting, it's still, I think, an open question how you make a, like, at the moment, Google can make this 100 transmon system, and they, I mean, you can still sort of brute force it. But of course, if you want to go to a million, eventually you need to think.
I have only very limited understanding of this, but the way I see it, there was this old, and it means now 2 or 3 years old, IBM approach, fixed frequency architectures. We essentially, I think that's one way of saying what you say, is they come up with frequency patterns, different transmons, and try to engineer them in such a way that the system is more or less under control. But it's not under control to the extent that one would like to have it. And plan B is tunable couplers, where you really isolate your transmons as long as they are not needed in operation. But that also comes as a price. You have to have a large number amount of hardware overhead. Mm-hmm. So the qubit footprint gets a lot larger. And with the transmons, it's really uncomfortably large. That's, I think, why we have 100 qubits and not 1,000. And all this wiring and is getting more and more involved. So I don't know where it's going at this point.
Yeah, I guess, but a similar thing will happen with, like, if people start scaling up the Rydberg atoms.
Yes.
Yeah. You have a similar problem. And yeah. You even have the problem that those do not have natural disorder. They are actually...
Precisely. Yeah. No, they don't need it. Because
they don't need...
They're much cleaner. Rydberg is just a three-level system, the Rydberg qubit. And it's I talked a lot to our AMO physicist in Bonn, I mean, to Sebastian Hofer-Bert, so they really tell me, this Rydberg is really mathematically clean compared to the transmon Hamiltonian, which is much more complex.
You don't have these higher levels. Yeah.
Exactly. But in fact, it's a major part of our proposal is precisely this argument that all of these established qubit technologies will reach their limit, not in the 100,000 qubit range, but thousands. And from that point on, we probably have to build modules and connect them, which is the mission of ML4Q, right? I mean...
Yeah, and you really show, there's already, we can show here that there's a lot of internal connections going on.
Yeah.
So apart from working, so for the last 7 years, you were one of the people within ML4Q and working with different collaborators, but now ML4Q is in the stage of being renewed. The Excellence Initiative needs, like, we want 7 more years of this cluster.
Mm-hmm.
And you stepped up with... partner spokespeople that you talked about, and there was a big coordination it's essentially a new funding round, right?
Yes.
Sort of a new application. Mm-hmm. What got you into this? How did you step up to this position?
Well, it wasn't an active process in any way, and I was not even a part of the steering, how do we call it? Steering committee of ML4Q.
Yeah.
So I followed what ML4Q from the beginning and was involved in thinking ML4Q, but was never particularly close to its leadership. But at some point, the body of ML4Q people really thought that the field has changed beyond recognition in these last 7 years, and we have changed, and we have to think the project anew, and one person had to coordinate this. And there were lots of people who could have done that, and none of us wanted, actually, which is a good thing. I mean, you don't want people who are too ambitious to. it's just who would be ready to actually sacrifice their research for 2.5 years? That was the price to pay. At the same time, find this job fascinating enough to actually go there. I mean, it's a challenge, and we absolutely had to enter this renewal process. And I eventually, it was a collective decision. I do it. And I was thinking twice and triple about it, because I have done similar jobs with CRCs before. And I knew what odd amount of work that was. So I thought, maybe it's of that scale. But what I didn't know then is that it was actually much, much more. But yeah, that's how it just happened.
One of the really smart decisions was to keep the sort of running of MF. Like another thing was that this renewal process, you started to go into it and build a team to do that. It was sort of separate of the running cluster, which also is smart to keep it running at sort of full speed ahead for.
Yes.
For the remainder of of the
it's
funding.
Yeah. I'm quite grateful to UET and that this worked in this way.
Yeah.
And it would not have been possible otherwise. We just had to have start from a clean slate and think anew and have the backing of the running cluster, and in particular also the full backing of its administrative powers. Well, that was otherwise it would not have worked.
As a seasoned professor, do you still get stage fright or nervous in situations like this, where there's literally millions of euros and the future of more than 100 people at stake?
Whether I get nervous? Oh, totally. I mean, I have never been so nervous in my academic life than before this MFOQ final showdown session. You know, exactly for the reason. Not just that, but you if you work on anything, and it doesn't matter what scale, you build a hut or whatever, 2.5 years, just full time more or less, and then comes a singular event where you are nervous.
Yeah,
I mean it's just human.
And so how, like, I guess you guys started with like some meetings and mind maps on how you would put this new proposal together.
Mm-hmm.
How do you unify this vision? I mean, ML4Q, as we said, it's matter and light. It's already sort of everything that we know working together for quantum computing. And you have 20 plus powerful professors in their own right who come together. How do you put this together?
Yeah, that was an organic process. I mean, first of all, it's not 20 plus, more like 50 plus, if you count all really people who contribute to our science. And what we started with, I think, I don't know whose idea it was, I mean, it doesn't matter anymore, is we formed this initially called Chaos Group, then Concept Group, a group of about 9-10 people came and came and went, but it was almost a body of about 10 people from different nodes, different orientations, different tastes, different everything. And this group has met first on a monthly basis and later weekly basis throughout these 2.5 years, and solved all the issues. It was really a super collaborative and constructive process. I mean, we had our rough patches where we really, didn't like what, but it was always constructive. And that group came then up with this idea of how to pattern our research, how to organize our research, how to distribute finances. So it was a highly interactive, and my I don't want to downplay my role, but it was simply as one who coordinates this communicative process. In the turn of these events, we also formally we were thinking in terms of different nodes. I mean, it's Aachen, Bonn, and we have to balance our resources. All this stopped. We no longer think in terms of different nodes or different disciplines. We just do what's best for the project. It maybe sounds a bit over, but it's really how it is.
So yeah, that indeed, that's of course an important thing. Like, I guess this locality thing does play a bit in favor of ML4Q, that it sort of encompasses a lot of the North Rhine-Westphalia quantum information effort. Not all, but let's say a very big chunk of it. When you guys were writing the proposal, how much do you look at the other clusters versus how much do you just think what is the best that we can do with our current, how do we see the current situation going forward 7 years? And
Looking at, first of all, about the state, we I think, yeah, we are a major part of this, and we've partnered with Paderborn, which is another, so photonic quantum computing. So now we really have quite a lot, and we also have our synapses to Siegen, where we have ion quantum computing. So we are pretty strong, I think, in North Rhine-Westphalia. Concerning the other clusters, I think we are partners and competitors at the same time, and we have of course carefully monitoring and watching what the other guys are doing, and they have their own strengths and profiles. So we positioned ourselves at the one cluster with dedicated going on into just quantum computing. I mean, all of them or many have a quantum computing component, but it's really our sole focus. And within that, we emphasize this condensed matter and AMO and device cooperation. So this makes us different from sufficiently different that we have a healthy position, I think, to continue.
How do you see ML4Q contributing to Germany's position in global quantum research over the next decade?
Yeah, we just want to crack one of your hard problems. That's, if we do that, we have fulfilled our mission alongside or next to building here a research structure. But we have set ourselves goals. And I mean, an easy one to mention is, can we do the topological qubit? Yes or no? We want to find out. We are not promising we will get it, but we promise to find out in the next 7 years if it has. And there are similar goals, similar caliber for three other qubit platforms we are working on. So I'm not saying that we, again, I'm repeating myself, that we will reach them. But if we reach any of those, then it will be noticed on the global scale.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe one more question about sort of what to expect from ML4Q or... So the excellence clusters, they are a way to administer funds, but should they also significantly improve the lives of the PhD students and postdocs that sort of make up the large part of the scientific workforce?
Yeah, of course, totally. I mean, you're getting me into the proposal mode, but no, absolutely. And I think we did really well. I mean, we have produced, I don't know, it's the number is going up. We have 15 or 16 faculty as a cluster. So 50% of the postdocs who left us made it to academia, to permanent positions, which is quite strong, I think. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. Another one is, I mean, at least we try to create a good and wholesome working atmosphere or contribute to it by instruments we have in the cluster. So we are... thinking a lot about work atmosphere and even very practical things like mental health issues and all that is part of the mission. And to what degree we are successful, we have to see. But judging on where we are now, I think, I mean, also the feedback we get, anonymous feedback, shows that we're on a good path, I think,
in this regard.
I'm always happy to go on record. I think the ML4Q office has, for example, helped me a lot with family work organization. And I think that's the difference to a CRC, right? Like in a CRC, how many people do you have on the administrative
side?
Yeah,
exactly. It's not can't be compared. We have five professionals, PhD professionals in ML4Q. And
exactly. Like this cluster office.
It's a lot of muscle.
Which
they help in all kinds of aspects, right? I mean, outreach and mental issues and dual career stuff. I mean, yeah.
Exactly. I think that's also why it's so important that we keep this cluster here.
Yes.
Because it really makes a difference for the people who work here.
Yes. So maybe we can come back to your work in condensed matter quantum field theory. You wrote a textbook on condensed matter quantum field theory. How would you explain this field to someone who's unfamiliar with it?
How you explain or motivate quantum field theory?
Yeah.
With the more is different paradigm, perhaps. So you take a condensed matter system, which means all that surrounds this is condensed matter. Mm-hmm. It's usually straightforward to write down a quantum description of it, a Hamiltonian, what we call it. But then you have this wealth of phenomena the systems show, and the connection between this Hamiltonian you can write down and what you actually see is deeply non-trivial. And it's a bit like the difference between psychology and sociology. Yeah? You can write down, define an individual psychological actor, and it's relatively straightforward compared to what the whole society is doing. And quantum field theory is a method of choice to describe these sociological, these large-scale phenomena in a way that's whose power is just unparalleled. Yeah, and that's what always fascinates me. Not just me, I mean, it's what fascinates people about this field. And about this book, I mean, when I grew up, I always knew I wanted to learn it, but there were only these super hard French textbooks out there and the Russian textbooks, and I always felt a bit stupid when I read them. I mean, it's easy to show that, and it wasn't just easy for me. So we tried to, at the time we wrote it, end of 90s, this was one of the first friendly, where you actually, you talk to people in a friendly, down-to-earth. There was one other by Fredkin that was similar. But that was what made us write this book, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you solve problems, do you think in equations, in concepts, or in visualizations in field theory?
That's a good one. A bit of both, I guess. Yeah. But I'm a bit of both. I never thought, interesting, and it never came up this question, actually. I never thought about it, how I think about.
I always thought, like, when I saw the lecture, like, when I had lectures in field theory, you know, it always, somebody writes down some integral, and then at some point they draw a complex plane and they say, you know, there's these, these poles or whatever, and then they say, okay, but if you integrate like this, it's all trivial, and then they give you the solution.
Yeah, I love that. I feel very much at home in this way of thinking.
Exactly. But for me as an outsider, I learned it a little bit, but this connection between the visualization and the math is not at all trivial at all.
Yeah, but sometimes math doesn't want to be visualized. It just wants to be kept on an algebraic level.
Yeah, exactly. So
it can be a... Sometimes too much of visualization can be a sweet poison.
Yeah.
One example is, if you always think of vectors in terms of little arrows, and then somebody comes and tells you, oh, you expand functions of a sphere in a complete set of basis functions, so all of a sudden it's no longer arrows, it's functions. The intuition of linear algebra still works, but the visualization is no longer good.
Yeah. So you're actually at home with the equations as well.
Yeah, if you do that for as long as I've done it, at some point it just sinks in to some degree.
I was wondering like whether somebody looks at an equation and sort of imagines the sort of this integration path or decide.
I don't know. I have some kind of there are these synesthetic phenomena. You know, in my mind, I know that when I imagine numbers, they always follow a distinct string. So there's this three-dimensional line in my head and it doesn't go away. It's always like 7 is there, then comes 8, then a corner, 10. But that's a stupid analogy. But I think all our minds do these funny things.
Quantum field theory is a field of, like, it is a field of legit geniuses occasionally, right? Like the people who drive the field forward, like this, occasionally people who come in and they do things that people before didn't expect, like.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another interesting one. In the olden days, first three quarters of the 20th century, physics was much smaller. We had only very few people. And I think those few we have been exposed to a super cruel selection process. Then many more people started doing physics, and now it's extreme, to my mind, and the publication output, they told me at FISREF doubles every 10 years. So we became a bit like a swarm intelligence, much stronger communication networks, which actually drive the field and shape the field. And then you still have your occasional geniuses who act as a vector, so the swarm follows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting sociological question, I think, how this changed progress. We definitely have more of these fashion phenomena these days. And hard to tell. History will show us where it's going.
Yeah.
In condensed matter field theory, there's also this universality classes. So what is universality in physics and why is it important?
Yeah, in my way of thinking, I mean, that's very subjective, but universality is the most powerful, the hardest currency we have. I mean, it's the more universal things get, the more interesting I find them. yeah, but the answer, I mean, textbook answer is you have lots of different systems that are different microscopically, but show similar phenomena. Like lots of magnets behaving in the same way or showing water or liquid showing same type of phase transitions. And personally, I find this the most, the more universal something becomes, the more powerful and fascinating as a concept to explain. So it's always like a drawing instance that draws me. That's also why I like chaos and disorder so much. I don't think of them. Many people think about disorder as something like, you know, you have a system, a clean system that interests you, and then comes this parasitic disorder nobody wants to hear about, and it makes things more complicated. But for me, it's different. When I have a system, like, say, a system showing some kind of phase transition, I'm not usually interested in this particular system, but rather an equivalence class of systems that are similar and still show the same physics. And similar means that I'm actually thinking about an ensemble of systems that are microscopically different, and I want to average over this ensemble to describe properties that are universal, that survive this averaging. And that's another way of saying that I average over disorder, in quotes. Yeah? So disorder is a source of universality and simplicity.
Mm.
That's why I like it so much.
Is it for, like, I don't know, I mean, you have things like Anderson localization or something.
Yeah, but you can even do it, consider simpler. For example, in school or in physics, or entry-level physics, we learn that microcanonical ensemble, yeah, pretty much the most universal phase in classical physics. Everything is smeared out.
Yeah.
So you can ask, what is the quantum analog of that? And that's just the physics of the maximally chaotic quantum Hamiltonian. So that is the quantum defines the quantum generalization of the most universal phase in nature we have. So it's even more universal because it's no, it's a quantum. And now you can introduce additional rules into the game. You can say you have a certain symmetry or you have certain topology in addition to this. And this is approaching physics from an extremely universal viewpoint, which I just like.
Is topology still a, like, I don't know, I work on topological insulators, but I sometimes have the feeling that the word topology, you know, it's originally from math, from deep mathematics and about stuff being close to each other in a weird sense. But in physics, people use it in different ways. And it's like, how concrete is the word still to you? Like, what is?
Yeah, first of all, I think you are right. I mean, the ultimate authority is math. There's just no. But then we come with our physical systems and they realize elements of this mathematics, much like quantum mechanics realizes elements of some mathematics. And it then boils down of how versatile and gifted we are in unlocking and communicating and working with these mathematical concepts. And there it really, for example, when I was young, I mean, Chern number, yeah, was some super abstract concept for mathematics. These days, every experimental physics talks every day about Chern numbers in their labs. So it's a mathematical concept. It will remain a mathematical concept, and we are abusing them a little to be able to actually work with them, depending on our background. But it's a very healthy relationship, I think.
Your paper on non-standard symmetry classes was recognized as a PRB milestone.
I don't know what a PRB milestone is, actually.
I think they had 50 years of PRB and they named 50 papers they thought were worthwhile.
Most really? Impactful,
yeah. No, honestly, I didn't know that.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's one per year. Well, that's not bad.
It's not bad. No, they publish probably 1,000 per year, right, or something. I don't know.
Piabino a lot more than some, but it's a good paper.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But so what was the core insight then?
Yeah,
the
core insight. Could you explain what non-standard symmetry classes are and what's their significance in mesoscopic systems?
Yeah, so physics is a lot about symmetry. Yeah, you talk about a system is rotationally invariant or has a rotation symmetry around an axis, and we call these symmetries in the technical jargon of physics unitary symmetries. These are the symmetries we are most translational symmetries, one of them. But then they are also anti-unitaries. These are different symmetries, but no less powerful, on the contrary. An example is you ask yourself, suppose you lived in a universe where time went backwards. So will the rules of nature change in a fundamental way or not? This is time reversal symmetry. Mm. And another one is, say, it's to do, you invert all the charges in the universe. So in particle physics, they knew some. They were had quite a prominent role always. And one thing we understood then was that in physics you have to distinguish between precisely 10 of these classes. So you have like 10 boxes, and where these antilinear symmetries are concerned, you can put your systems into one of these 10s. And three of them had been quite well established at the time when we wrote this. So the other 7 we therefore called non-standard. And so at the time we described these 10 and described their physical properties primarily with regard to disordered systems again, because they were the most universal to think about, and invented some random matrix models describing them. And this didn't draw much attention for a few years, until the topology revolution started. And the concept of topology were fused with the symmetry. So we're thinking about topological phenomena in certain symmetry classes, and this is when all this topological meta stuff. So it was a bit foundational for that, I think.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, maybe just a big interlude on the random matrix theory, because I was like, when you say random matrix theory, like today, like somebody like me, I would think, well, you know, I take a computer, I generate 100 random matrices, I, you know, do some things with them, and I check whether things do behave the way I expect. But the formalism that you were using is very, like, it's actually not at all that. It's very mathematical and abstract and algebraic.
I wouldn't call it abstract. It's intuitive.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, you abstract in the sense that, you know, it's not a concrete matrix. Like, you probably don't even have to specify the dimension of the matrix, you can say.
No, you specify the dimension, but what your friend is averaging, your average over. Yeah. Look, it's instructive to recall how a random matrix idea came up in the 30s or late 20s even, Wigner. So I give you a Hamiltonian. Think of a nucleus. And you think information, actually it was an information-inspired way of thinking about it. You assume you know nothing about this Hamilton. You have no knowledge other than its average energy, number of particles in it. So how would you describe it? What would be a Hamiltonian which you write down, which doesn't assume any previous knowledge, and so it must maximize entropy? And Wigner came up with the answer. It's a Gaussian distributed Hamiltonian, what we call a random matrix Hamiltonian. So this high level of entropy actually helps a lot in analytical calculations. You can average relatively effortlessly over ensembles of these guys because there is so little structure in these averages that you don't have to have a computer to make strong statements. That's the beauty of the concept, actually.
This also then, like, let's say a lot of this mesoscopic physics then relates to superconductivity and semiconductors and within ML4Q in the Majorana, right? Mm-hmm. Can you explain maybe how to go from the abstract symmetries to the more concrete super semi?
Yeah, it's actually funny. She said when we wrote our symmetry class paper, these were the 90s and quantum chaos, we were thinking of systems that would realize these non-standard symmetries and be experimentally realizable. And what we came up with were superconductor, semiconductor billiards. So the semiconductor, just then we call it class A or class A1 or A2. I mean, the standard. But if you attach a superconductor, you get these charge conjugation properties. This So they would, these billiards would show the random properties if they were chaotic billiards we were expecting. So we talked to experimentalist Charlie Marcus, who later became famous in Majorana physics, or was already famous then. And he told us semiconductor and superconductor coupling, no way, they hate each other. So you cannot do it. So that's why we were then quite surprised and delighted when people thought hard later about, inspired by this or motivated by this topology stuff, how to actually make these systems.
And indeed, the super, what's the symmetry the superconductor brings in? What's the?
Well, you have these symmetries under charge conjugation that distinguish a BCS superconductor and sense the system, say, from a symmetry class we call A to D or BD1 or class D, which is the Majorana wire.
Yeah.
These are all non-standard symmetry classes, depending on their behavior under time reversal and superconducting pairing symmetries.
And on paper, this is all very easy, but in practice, indeed, putting together the super and the semi will probably continue for the next years to have a lot of debate about Majorana. Like, you know, there's not going to be the easy, this is perfectly Majorana. It's just the way that it is in the textbook.
Yeah, you tell me, you are the expert. I mean, no, but easy it is not. But then it is also no rocket. This one says it's no rocket science. I mean, it's a band structure effect, right? We are talking about it. It's not super mysterious physics. It's a band structure effect, and this bloody Majorana must be there.
Yeah.
The only question is if we can isolate it.
And if the system is clean enough to sort of show.
Yeah, but no, wait, hold on. I mean, the Majorana actually, it's interesting. It tolerates.
It doesn't get destroyed, but it gets hidden by other stuff.
It gets maybe masked a little, but it can. I mean, including in ML4Q, we came up with measurement protocols which strangely are not noticed very much, but short of braiding, but much better than tunnel spectroscopy, which should tell us if we are there or not. But we're still waiting for you guys.
Yes, that's true. You have not only written a book on condensed matter field theory, but also on mathematics for physicists. So maybe already, were you always passionate about teaching, or did it sort of happen as you became a professor and then you had to do it?
No, I always like to teach. I mean, I'm for two reasons. One is I like interaction in a lecture hall, just subjective. I don't know why, but I like it. And another one is that I like learning stuff. But for me, the best way of learning stuff is to give a lecture. And it really forces me to get into a subject. And then I have to write some notes. And from there, it's not far to writing a book. So I find this very rewarding. Yeah. And entry-level math is indeed one of the passionate subjects.
Was it teaching that inspired you to write the textbooks? Or were they two separate endeavors?
Well, I don't know. Writing textbooks, strangely, has for me a very, it's odd to say, but it has a relaxing influence. So when I write a paper, I always think, oh, there are these colleagues who are breathing down my neck. But when I write a textbook, it's a service to people who are like me, just learning something. So I try to explain things the way I can understand them. I just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And drawing figures and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Is there a theoretical minimum that every physicist should know in terms of math?
No, I wouldn't put it this way, but I think the way we have been teaching math and physics, or are most universities we are teaching mathematics, is just wrong. Often mathematics is reduced to methods. Yeah, we even call it mathematical methods, but math is so much more for us. It's a language in which we talk. It's the concepts we use. I mean, they are really, we owe them to mathematics. And this isn't to say that we need a whole lot more of math. We just need, I think, a somewhat different approach to learning mathematics. So what we usually do is we either outsource it to the mathematicians, which is fine. They think conceptually, but they don't think in the direction that is, they are more proof-oriented and not so physics-oriented. Or we teach it ourselves, and it's often degraded down to diff and crot and that, I mean, some soulless methods, And I think there is this, there is a middle way between these two, which is us teaching mathematics, but in ways which are a bit more conceptual and not so. And I think it's especially helpful for students who are not so strong. The strong students, they immediately grasp all these connections, but the somewhat weaker students, for them, say a conceptual approach to introducing vectors, as opposed to vectors is just arrows in some vector space, is extremely helpful and important. And this is what I understand as conceptual math teaching. And we just wrote a book about it. And it changed the culture of math teaching in Cologne here, I think.
Yeah. What, according to you, is the best format for teaching mathematics or theoretical physics? Is it traditional lectures, or is it this flipped classroom concept? Or is it something entirely different?
I have no clue. I really don't know. But I know that in Corona times, we experimented a lot. And it's apparent that we went back to the conventional lecture course format, which maybe a lack of imagination or may tell us that it's actually not so bad after all. Our colleagues in didactics tell us that no person can stay awake for 90 minutes and be exposed to this information inflow. So, but I still think old school lecture is not so bad. But this simply may mean that I haven't really, that I'm just not agile enough to do these flipped classroom things.
I mean, the other thing, now we have these computers, which like, let's say with an AI assistant, you can even have it write the Python code for you to integrate something, right?
Sure.
Like, I don't even have to be able to program anymore. I can now just go to and say, ChatGPT, please solve this integral for me. And maybe even show me a derivation. We're not so far away from this. Does this change how we teach people? Will this change how we teach people?
I'm not sure. Actually, it's interesting. I mean, we bought a Mathematica license campus-wide. So I'm trying to integrate a lot of Mathematica into my courses, show them nice pictures which I generated, and we encourage them on the tutorial sheets to work a bit with Mathematica. The resonance to that, the reception is actually not so strong as I would have thought it would be. Students strangely seem to prefer the old school way of doing it and not become quite so quickly so computational. That changes a little later. I mean, we have these super excellent computational physics classes at Cologne, and I mean, but at the early stages of teaching, I'm not sure if ChatGPT and co. will change.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, when I have to teach students about, like, the experimental class on electromagnetism, you have all the integrals and stuff, and I'm terrible at them. So if I have to, like, this Blackboard teaching that you theoretical physics professors do, it's amazing, right? Like, you go and you fill 9 blackboards with ideally very few mistakes in complex derivations that you...
Yeah, that's now a bit strong, but I mean...
But what I mean is, like, I usually tell the students that, like, if I had to solve these integrals in front of people in the class, like, I really struggle, and I'm always like, you know, I don't even solve these anymore. When I run into a problem like that, I just solve it on my computer.
Yeah, that you can do that, but and maybe you should, because your priorities are different, but every single integral we encounter in electrodynamics class is a living being. I mean, they have a soul, these integrals, and if you put them into Mathematica, you don't see it anymore. It becomes a structure, right? But
yeah,
you know, manipulating the integral and evaluating in different parameter regimes teaches one so much about actual physics phenomena.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, we talked earlier, like, there's this field theory tradition, and like the quantum field theory tradition, and these theorists who worked on this were a lot of, like, we're working in a time, like, let's say, like, the 60s to 80s or whatever, you didn't even have the chance to. You had to look them up in tables, or you had to be really good at integrating stuff yourself. And a lot of these people were probably still good at integrating this, and it changed their intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe they were able to see things.
Yeah, but you don't have to go to the field theory level. I mean, take a little antenna, and it radiates an electromagnetic field. So you have a relatively benign-looking integral. It's half a line that actually describes the radiation field in terms of this source. And it has different regimes in which you can evaluate the Taylor expand here or there in this parameter. And they all tell you, oh, you know, you get a spherical wave. Now you get planar wave and whatever. So you can call it integrating, but you can also call it physics, right?
I mean, sure, exactly. It's like, yeah. It's important for intuition. Like, yeah. this algebra, like the intuition based on the equations actually does help.
Yes.
Like there's an equation-based intuition and there's sort of a visual intuition and they relate.
Yeah.
And the numerics can actually make it easy for you, because if you do the numerics, you can just look at it. You know, you can, like, I'm interested in this vector field. Mm. And I, you know, program it into my computer and I can look at what it looks like. And then I can think maybe this inspires me to solve
it. Sure. That's totally okay. What I tend to avoid is doing, even in my research, doing integrals mathematica, I try to not to, because I usually miss out when I do that.
So you really
I have a bug in my code and I don't notice. And I mean, yeah.
So you do solve these equations?
Yes, I try to work most if I can. Mm-hmm.
So indeed, I mean, if you have a lot of this practice of solving the equations, it also gets easier to sort of teach these classes in front of students, right? Because the most amazing theoretical physics class is the one where a student asks the question and the teacher then says, well, let me just solve this other integral that you just mm-hmm. asked about and show you guys that I can do this. But
These are the situation where you expose yourself because you don't know if
you don't know if it's gonna go well.
Yeah, you don't know if it goes well. It always rises the blood pressure a little bit.
Okay, it's very good to see that you still.
No, absolutely. I mean, facing a lecture hall is a scary situation. I mean, it's 100 people looking at you. You can easily embarrass yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We're probably covered a nice amount of. Topics now. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me and asking these nice questions. Yeah.